This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, August 4th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Hillary Clinton finally seems to have found an effective way to define herself in this campaign. Here's part of what she had to say last week at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia.
And in the end, it comes down to what Donald Trump doesn't get. America is great because America is good. So, enough with the bigotry and the bombast. Donald Trump's not offering real change. He's offering empty promises. And what are we offering? A bold agenda to improve the lives of people across our country, to keep you safe, to get you good jobs, to give your kids the opportunities they deserve. The choice is clear, my friends.
Ben Wallace Wells joins me to discuss how Clinton intends to win over voters who continue to mistrust and dislike her in very large numbers. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Dorothy.
I have to say, I'm having a hard time recalling anything that Clinton has said since the convention. It's all about Trump still every day. We've got, you know, the attacks on the Muslim parents of an American soldier, the crying baby at a campaign stop, and then the refusal to endorse Paul Ryan and John McCain. I'm assuming it's not going to be this easy for the rest of the campaign and that she's going to have to appeal to two very different camps, diehard Sanders supporters on the one hand and longtime Republican voters on the other. How does she do it?
The interesting thing about the convention was just how much territory the Democrats staked out ideologically. The party on view at the convention ranged from the Bernie Sanders supporters screaming no more wars from, you know, the California delegation to a really bloodthirsty retired general, John Allen, talking about how Clinton was going to defeat and kill the forces of evil in the world. You had, on the one hand, a kind of party whose center had moved to an opposition to trade agreements, at least some trade agreements, and on the other hand, a party that was putting Mike Bloomberg in the center of its final appeal, and more recently accepting the endorsement of Meg Whitman, the former Republican candidate for governor of California. And so at a basic ideological level, there is no way that the party can be all things to such a broad swath.
And it highlights part of the problem that she has, too. Doesn't it, this add to the impression that so many have that she's just a cynic and will appeal to whoever she needs to in order to get the vote?
It does. And I would add also to the kind of lack of specificity in her campaign. Sanders ran a very specific campaign. It was very clear throughout the primary what idea Bernie Sanders had of the future of the country. It was never at any point particularly clear what idea Hillary Clinton had of the future of the country. But I think that there is a kind of temptation towards seeing her as cynical. Where I think I might disagree with you is I'm not sure she's really going to have to resolve that in this political campaign. We're less than 100 days from the end of the campaign now. Trump is down about 10 points in national polls. In polls in places like Georgia, he's only even with Clinton. He's trailing in places like Arizona. He's in double-digit deficits in places he needs to win, like Pennsylvania.
But haven't the polls been consistently wrong in this campaign?
Well, the polls are very right in the Republican primary. You know, I don't expect that those margins will sustain themselves through the end of the campaign. But when you have, you know, really open warfare like we're seeing this week in the Republican camp, when you have Trump seemingly unable to stop himself from making error after error after error, I do wonder a little bit whether Clinton may just be able to coast through these last 3 months a little bit more than we've been suspecting she would.
Let's talk about a couple of the issues that are out there and still could hurt her. So there's the ever-present private email server at the State Department, and we've been having Julian Assange, who founded WikiLeaks, claiming to have incredibly damning evidence about her. I watched him being interviewed last night, saying that he had documents that prove her malfeasance above and beyond what we know, but I could not figure out what he was saying.
I can't either. There's also some suggestion that he has documents not just from the DNC, but also from the Clinton Foundation. And That's interesting, too. From, you know, before the beginning of this presidential campaign, the assumption had been that one of Hillary Clinton's great weaknesses was the wheeler-dealerness, the cronies, the deals the Clinton Foundation cut with pretty nasty governments overseas and their representatives. And that has not really touched her in this campaign. And that might have been surprising a year ago that that had not come up.
What if he has something? He keeps promising or threatening to release these things.
It depends sort of how bad it is. You have a hard time imagining that Hillary Clinton, you know, an absolute lawyer's lawyer, would allow herself to become personally implicated in any kind of pay-for-play scenario. And obviously, we're wildly speculating. We have no idea what's in those emails. But, you know, the kind of milder scandal of what was in the classified emails on her private server suggests that, like, you know, people around her are not always so diligent about paying attention to rules and protocols. One thing that I think has happened in this election that maybe mutes the possibility of a total change in the election is that Donald Trump has turned out to be just as cronyist, maybe obviously more in some ways than Hillary Clinton. You know, he surrounded himself with aides like Paul Manafort and Carter Page, the oil and gas consultant. It's not clear that a Donald Trump administration would be any purer than a Hillary Clinton one.
You yourself have read hundreds of Clinton's unclassified emails, so I can't resist asking you what you found in them.
Very little. A lot of mundanity. I mean, one interesting thing is that the Clinton orbit has shifted. We had this suspicion, as I mentioned a little while ago, that this kind of cronyist network of old Clintonites would continue to, like, surround Hillary Clinton herself and complicate her presidency. But beginning with her time in the State Department, you see her day-to-day correspondence just relying on, you know, a handful of much younger aides who are close to her now, but are in their 30s and early 40s, who were not around during the first Clinton administration. And on the campaign, in kind of interesting ways, she's continued that tendency. You know, she's not really surrounded by the old Clinton standbys.
But you assume that in her cabinet and in her inner circle in general, there will be old Clinton hands as well.
Oh, of course. But I think that one of the heartening things for liberals about Hillary Clinton's campaign, particularly on the policy side, is that it does show signs of a recognition of the movement that the party has gone through over the last 10 years.
And do you, this lingering question about her ties to Wall Street, which is a big question, and, you know, the fact that she was paid almost $700,000 for three speeches to Goldman Sachs and her refusal to release the transcripts, that fact, which Trump has been trying to exploit, certainly was trying to exploit earlier in the campaign, is worrisome and problematic.
Absolutely. There were signs in the negotiations of the platform with Sanders that on certain issues she was willing to nudge a bit leftward. But on these sort of central questions about, you know, inequality and the structure of economic possibility, we haven't heard a great deal more than platitudes from her. I think that one kind of big current in this election, and even in the second half of the Obama administration generally, is that there is a broad recognition that the difficulties that people have in America in getting ahead are very, very long-term and structural. And one, I think, central question that would face Hillary Clinton should she win this election is, how does she address that?
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I want to get back to your point earlier about terrorism, because Trump has played this card pretty well throughout the campaign. I just want to play a bit from one of his speeches. This one happened to be in New York in June.
The Hillary Clinton foreign policy has cost America thousands of lives and trillions of dollars and unleashed ISIS across the world. No Secretary of State has been more wrong, more often, and in more places than Hillary Clinton. Her decision spread death, destruction, and terrorism everywhere she touched.
So what about that, Ben?
I mean, as much as we heard from the Democrats about Hillary Clinton's historical preparedness for the role as president, her tenure as Secretary of State on the big decisions, her active encouragement of Libya intervention, the long-running difficulties that the United States, the Obama administration, had in figuring out exactly what to do about Syria. Her record does not look great. And even if you don't agree with Trump on Iran, I don't think you take a cold-eyed look at her tenure as Secretary of State and say, this is a master of foreign policy. And so we talk a lot about how Hillary Clinton is vulnerable as a person. It's been a main theme in the coverage of this election. But we haven't talked as much about the ways in which she is vulnerable as a policy actor. Mm-hmm. And I think both in her tenure as Secretary of State and in her rhetoric and the overhang of the Clinton administration and her relationship with Wall Street as a senator from New York, there was a lot of room to attack her. You could imagine a more detail-oriented candidate than Donald Trump, who was able to make a less abstract and more human case against the kind of continuing economic divides in America, who was able to really inhale the detailed criticisms of what we did in Libya beyond the kind of Fox News gloss on Ambassador Stevens' death.
Ted Cruz, for one, it would have been interesting to see a debate between Ted Cruz and Hillary Clinton.
Even a clumsier and more emotional politician like Chris Christie, one of them up against Clinton, could have been very devastating for her. But, you know, that's not what we've got. We've got Donald Trump. And 100 days isn't no time. This race will probably take some turns. But based on everything we've seen for the last 15 months, it's hard to see Trump or the campaign apparatus which exists around him really drilling down into those details and really making not just a kind of first-line case against Hillary Clinton, but really describing her errors in a way that seems compelling and seems like he would be a better alternative.
I was thinking this week about a piece that Henry Louis Gates wrote two decades ago for this magazine about Hillary. It was called Hating Hillary. And Gates said, in the course of a single conversation, I have been assured that Hillary is cunning and manipulative, but also crass, clueless, and stunningly impolitic, that she is a hopelessly woolly-headed do-gooder and at heart a hardball litigator, that she is a base opportunist and a zealot convinced that God is on her side. What emerged is a cultural inventory of villainy rather than a plausible depiction of an actual person. And Trump, of course, has a genius for tapping into exactly that vein.
That dichotomous element has dropped a bit, has diminished. I don't think people look at her and see a naive do-gooder, a deep believer, in the same way that they did in the early 90s. But the clarity, the fact that she is basically now, I think, just seen as a cynic by those who dislike her as dishonest, the clarity, the dropping of one end of that dichotomy, hasn't really eased the hate very much. The figure that Bernie Sanders describes when he talks about Hillary Clinton and the figure that Donald Trump describes, they're not very different. They're a kind of political calculator who has deep ties to the American establishment. And the astonishing thing about this election is that it probably won't matter. The hatred won't matter because her opponent is seen as, you know, unqualified and disliked, you know, very marginally, but disliked even more than she is. That is sort of astonishing. I think we could have imagined a couple of years ago a whole lot of ways this election would have gone, but that Hillary Clinton could look at this point, 100 days out, like she had a pretty clear path to winning the presidency without having become any more broadly liked than she was then.
With Republicans who are defecting, and I assume we'll be seeing more of them from the Republican Party, and have said they will vote for her, including this week, Republican Congressman from New York, Richard Hanna.
And Meg Whitman, yeah.
And Meg Whitman.
In an even more high-profile way. If we're thinking about this in competitive terms, given how precisely balanced the politics of the country are and how few real swing voters remain, if you start to lose even a small number of votes from your core of people that you counted on, you could have a huge amount of trouble winning the election.
Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks so much, Dorothy.
Benjamin Wallace Wells is a staff writer. His work has been collected in the Best American Political Writing. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Dubuff for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.